I next met with Dr. Sarah Hurvitz, and to begin, she commented on the ASCO meeting plenary presentation on the MA17R extension study evaluating the use of an additional 5 years of an adjuvant aromatase inhibitor.
What we now know about endocrine therapy, at least as far as tamoxifen goes, is that longer use does appear to improve outcomes compared to shorter use. So early studies showed that 5 years were better than 2.5 years. Then we have two large studies showing that 10 years of tamoxifen is better than 5 years of tamoxifen. That's from the Atlas and Adams studies in terms of diminishing long-term mortality from breast cancer. And the question that's sort of remained outstanding, and I have tons of patients waiting in the wings finding out, is whether or not continuing aromatase inhibitor therapy beyond 5 years adds benefit in terms of disease-free survival and long-term mortality. And so we haven't had data in this respect. We have data that shows that 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor improves outcomes after 5 years of tamoxifen. But we don't have data to tell us in patients who've completed 5 years of an AI, is adding another 5 years going to benefit them? So the MA17R study was designed to address this question directly. And the way it was designed was it allowed patients who had either received 5 years of tamoxifen followed by 5 years of an AI to go on and be randomized to receive another 5 years of an AI. And about 80% of the patients in that study fell into that category where they had already received 10 years total of endocrine therapy, or patients who'd not had tamoxifen but just had 5 years of an AI, randomized to receive 5 years of an AI or not. And what the results showed was that by doing the additional 5 years of the aromatase inhibitor after having 5 years, so 10 years of an AI, did actually improve outcomes. So there was about a 3% reduction in invasive disease-free survival events by the use of extended aromatase inhibitor therapy. So 10% of patients in the placebo arm had disease-free survival events and about 7% who had received the extended therapy. But this did not come without a cost. Patients who did do extended aromatase inhibitor therapy had higher rates of osteoporosis. They also had higher rates of fracture, so 9% versus 14% of patients having fracture. So I think it brings up an important point that we need to look at the patient sitting in front of us. What is their bone mineral density telling us? How high risk are they for fracture? How high risk are they for recurrence? And kind of do that scale analysis of risk versus benefits and deciding whether or not to apply these data to the patient sitting before you. In terms of quality of life, it was surprisingly quite similar between the two treatment arms. And I find that very surprising because most of my patients have a lot of difficulty with aromatase inhibitors in terms of joint pain and stiffness and cognitive fog, et cetera. So it could be that the patients were very selected because they had already completed 5 years of an AI and already tolerated it. So we're looking at, you know, a very select patient population.
The one thing about this is, I mean, the hazard rate in terms of recurrence was actually pretty significant. It was a hazard rate of 0.66 with 34% reduction in relapse, no survival benefit, which maybe you wouldn't expect, but also a real huge drop in contralateral disease, you know, in terms of prevention. It was pretty significant. What's this mean to you in terms of your own practice?
Well, what I kind of jumped to was the forest plot to see if there are subgroups that particularly benefit. And it did seem to indicate that lymph node positive was deriving more benefit, as you would expect. So just yesterday in clinic, I discussed this data with two patients, and one of whom was stage one, well-differentiated, and has severe osteopenia, not yet osteoporosis. She came off therapy 6 months ago, and I said, you know, I don't feel like we should put you back on therapy because we may be tipping the balance against you in terms of osteoporosis and fracture risk. However, you know, different patient with lymph node positive disease, I'd be inclined to go forward, especially if she had many nodes positive or higher grade disease, hadn't had chemo, et cetera. I think I would be more in favor of applying these data.
Of course, you know, at the beginning of this, in terms of ER positive, HER2 negative disease, you also have the issue of genomic factors. The MINDEC data now came out with MammaPrint at the AACR. Obviously, we've got Oncotype out there. But there have been attempts to find out, you know, what are predictors of recurrence after 5 years? There's a breast cancer index. What about genomic assays?
Yeah, I think that those are going to be increasingly useful in deciding who to give prolonged therapy to. And BCI so far has addressed the, you know, do we do 5 additional years after 5 years of tamoxifen? And, you know, that is useful, but not as useful as it will be if they can use that sort of genomic data for this type of study design. And there are other studies ongoing that haven't reported yet that will have a higher percentage of patients who did not receive 5 years of tamoxifen, so a higher percentage of patients who just went 5 years of AI versus 10 years of AI. And I think that's going to be more clinically applicable to our patients and doing genomic analyses to predict those patients who will be more likely to benefit is going to be really critical. I was looking for, you know, I'd be interested in seeing if PR negativity in this study would have predicted more benefit or less benefit, and invasive lobular as opposed to invasive ductal, those sort of simple things that don't require a sophisticated biomarker analysis, I think are also eagerly awaited.
So another thing I want to ask you about is we saw a bunch of papers, as we have for the last few years in ASCO, on CDK4/6 inhibitors, and you've been very involved with that research. First, we saw a couple of data sets looking at palbociclib, the drug that's approved. Anything that came out there in terms of subsequent mining of the data? And I guess also there was a new data set presented.
So PALOMA-2 data were presented. This was the phase 3 study that was the follow-up to the PALOMA-1 phase 2 clinical trial that led to the accelerated approval of palbociclib in the first-line setting for ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. There were about 660 patients enrolled in this clinical trial. Patients were randomized to placebo plus letrozole versus palbo plus letrozole. Again, this is the phase 3 trial that had a placebo control as part of the design, which is in contrast to the phase 1 data that Rich Finn published. And they confirmed the results of PALOMA-1 and showed that there was a 10-month improvement in progression-free survival with the use of palbociclib in the first-line setting. So about 14 and a half months for the placebo arm versus over 24.5 or 24.8 months for patients receiving palbociclib. So that really kind of confirms the incremental benefit that was seen in the phase 1 study. It also confirms the findings of the PALOMA-3 study, which were in the second and third line setting, and showing really, even if you look by different subsets and subgroups, that the benefit is seen across all subtypes. Objective responses were better, and of course, the main side effect and toxicity of this drug is neutropenia. So most of the grade 3, 4 side effects or adverse events are related to neutropenia, which can be managed quite easily by holding the drug and dose reductions. But it is something that is very common. Over 60% of patients will have grade 3, 4 neutropenia with this drug. But I think that 24.8 months of PFS is one of the longest PFSs reported in the first-line ER-positive metastatic setting. So it's really nice to see the field move forward in such a large jump. I'm really excited to see the Falcon data, which may have similar results with single agent fulvestrant versus first line AI. There was a press release at the end of May that the results, this is the phase 3 study that's confirming the phase 2 first trial, which was presented by Robertson, which looked at fulvestrant in the first line setting versus anastrozole, and fulvestrant had a better time to progression on the order of 23 months as a single agent compared to the first line AI. So the Falcon study is the phase 3 study that was aimed to confirm that, and the press release indicated they did meet that endpoint.
Although I'm not really sure exactly how much single agent hormonal therapy is being given for metastatic disease, it kind of seems like no matter what scenario we present to investigators, they all want to add palbo.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And so, you know, even if these data look really good when they ultimately present them, hopefully at ESMO or San Antonio, how applicable they'll be is unknown. Although outside of the United States, palbo isn't available. And so it may be that fulvestrant will become the first line therapy if these results have similar outcomes.
We'll get into this with your cases too, but I'm just kind of curious, can you describe a case right now where you would use hormonal therapy as first-line therapy in metastatic disease without palbo?
I suppose
I'll take
if
that
I had...
as a no.
Yeah.
I mean, what I've heard is sometimes people go, well, you have an older patient and they've got very indolent disease and it's not very aggressive. It's long disease-free survival.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah, or significant infection. I saw a patient yesterday who's got chronic aspergillosis and is, you know, probably would not do well with dealing with the neutropenia. And because we can use it in the second and third line setting, that particular patient. But it's few and far between that I would avoid using palbo.
So I was all set with this idea that CDK4/6 inhibitors are somehow synergistic with hormonal therapy. And then I started to hear about abemaciclib that you've done a lot of work on. And we did see data presented at ASCO in the so-called MONARCH 1 study. And the thing that was kind of cool about that was just abemaciclib alone.
Right.
So phase 2, what did they see there and what do you think it means?
Well, these were very heavily pretreated patients with ER-positive metastatic disease, and they were able to achieve an impressive progression-free survival and response rate with differing side effect profile compared to palbociclib. There are a lot of theories about why they are having a different side effect profile, but it's not yet quite been worked out. Maybe differential impact on CDK4 versus 6. So they're seeing less of the cytopenias and more liver toxicity and in terms of transaminase elevation and diarrhea, which appears to be managed fairly well with the use of loperamide. But you hit it spot on. Single agent activity, which hasn't been reported for other CDK4/6 inhibitors, continuous dosing. It's orally dosed twice a day, but you don't need to hold it 7 days in contrast to palbociclib and the other inhibitors. So the data is going to be very interesting. They have breakthrough status granted to them, similar to the way that palbo is developed. So it's unclear if they'll be getting an accelerated approval anytime soon, but the FDA is watching their data very closely. We currently have a neoadjuvant clinical trial ongoing called NeoMONARCH that will be presenting at ESMO, which is kind of an interesting trial design. It's basically a biomarker study. So ER-positive, HER2-negative postmenopausal patients with a breast tumor of at least a centimeter in size. And they are assigned to receive 2 weeks of abemaciclib plus anastrozole, or 2 weeks of anastrozole, or 2 weeks of abemaciclib with a biopsy at day 1 and 14. And then after day 14, all patients receive both drugs for the completion of 4 months and then go to surgery. And our endpoint is looking at change in Ki-67. And, you know, we're going to be exploring a lot of things, phospho-RB and, you know, that whole pathway, and just trying to understand if there are markers of response or resistance to this therapy. So I think there's going to be a lot more data coming out, especially with biomarker rich information to be provided.
Yeah, and I think until that comes out, it's maybe not going to be too clear what the future of monotherapy is. But the bottom line is, I mean, I've heard people who've been involved with these trials, I say, have you had any patients who had, you know, useful responses to abemaciclib alone? You know, the patient benefited, it lasted a while. And I've heard about cases like that. Have you had any cases like that?
I haven't yet because I wasn't participating in those early studies, but I have heard from colleagues and steering committees about very substantial responses that they're seeing in their patients.
And what about the neoadjuvant study, the NeoMONARCH? How many people have been treated so far? And is it blinded or do you know what they're getting?
It's open label. It's phase 2. So we do know what people are receiving. And we have, we're about 70% enrolled and our goal is just over 200 patients. It's an international trial. And, you know, what I've seen is a drop in Ki-67 from day 1 to day 14, which should be predictive of longer term outcome for patients if you follow the data in this setting.
What about actual tumor shrinkage neoadjuvantly?
So this is the patients I've put on are just beginning to go to surgery now, but clinically we're seeing remarkable softening of the tumor, becoming difficult to palpate, disappearance of lymph nodes by examination, but we'll have to see what the actual data shows. We're going to present it, the biomarker data at ESMO, and then hopefully have some clinical pathologic response data at San Antonio.
That'll be really interesting to see. I kind of have been hearing that still, like, maybe the future of abemaciclib is still going to be combined with hormonal therapy. Is that your take?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the direction things are moving. While their data is very exciting, they're late in the game. So I think from a company perspective, they're going to have to do what gives them the highest odds of yielding good responses. And I also think that these companies that are later in the game, ribociclib and abemaciclib, have got to be brave and look at other areas. For example, HER2 positive, which our laboratory, the work that we've done in looking at these molecules indicates that hitting the CDK4/6 pathway should be very effective in HER2 positive tumors. Not all HER2 positive tumors, but there's a lot of sensitivity there. It's a crowded field, so I think companies are a bit reluctant to go into that realm, but I think we're going to see some studies evaluating that.
That was the other thing I was actually going to ask you about, which is the triple positive kind of scenario. And of course, the approval for palbo is in HER2 negative disease, which kind of seems a little weird to me. But in any event, we always thought of the hormone pathways in HER2, at least clinically, sort of separately. Any reason to think that the benefits you see by adding on a CDK4/6 inhibitor would be different in a patient who has HER2 positive disease, even if they're on an anti-HER2 agent?
I think that the hormone pathway in HER2 positive disease makes the disease behave much differently. We see that in the neoadjuvant realm where pathologic complete responses are entirely different for an ER positive compared to ER negative HER2 positive tumor. When you are looking at studies that have done tissue analysis in the neoadjuvant setting, you can see that the biomarkers that seem to predict resistance to chemotherapy tend to be biomarkers and pathways that relate to the hormone pathway. And as I indicated, you know, the preclinical data indicates that CDK4/6 inhibition should be very effective in HER2 positive breast cancer. I think in a HER2 positive breast cancer, you need to inhibit the HER2 pathway, but I think you can get a lot more mileage out of also hitting the hormone pathway. And too few studies have been done to look at that clinically. And now I think we're seeing the design of more trials that are going to look at that clinically.
So speaking of that, I see you're part of an interestingly named and spelled trial, MONARCH-HER, MONARCH in lowercase, HER uppercase. Anyhow, it's a really interesting design, abemaciclib plus trastuzumab with and without fulvestrant. Sarah Tulaney is the overall PI. Can you talk a little bit about the thinking and the design of this study?
I was very happy to join this study because it does test clinically what we've shown preclinically. And so when you think about it, only about 20% at most patients have HER2 positive disease, and roughly 50% of those also have ER positive disease. So you're looking at 10% of all breast cancers qualifying for this study in a very crowded field where we're giving patients first line taxane, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and then T-DM1. So accrual, I think everyone is a little concerned about accrual to this study, but I can tell you that there is a lot of enthusiasm from patients and doctors for this study because it's addressing a very critical question, and that is, can we treat patients with ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer in a gentler, more targeted approach that doesn't involve, you know, traditional chemotherapy? So I think her design makes a lot of sense.
And from a clinical point of view, as long as you brought that up, in what situations with metastatic disease will you, you know, start out with hormone therapy and anti-HER therapy without chemo?
Rarely to never. I feel that if a woman is quite elderly and quite frail, it makes sense, although I may be inclined to use T-DM1 in that particular case. If you look at the TANDEM study, which looked at anastrozole trastuzumab versus anastrozole, I think that the results are unimpressive overall. It doesn't seem that adding endocrine therapy to single-agent HER2-targeted therapy adds a whole lot compared to single-agent HER2-targeted therapy. The EGF-3008 study of lapatinib versus lapatinib letrozole had similarly unimpressive results, in my opinion. So I think it's something that I use in a maintenance strategy. So I'll start patients with the 6 cycles of taxane-based therapy with HP. And then during the maintenance phase, when they're just getting the HER2-targeted therapy, add in hormonal therapy.
So as you mentioned, clinical trials obviously are very important for these patients. But again, outside of clinical trials, for patients with metastatic triple-negative disease, how do you, you know, sort of approach sequencing beyond anthracyclines and taxanes, and where does eribulin fit in?
So eribulin is a great drug, and I think the data as it relates to efficacy in triple negative is promising. What it usually comes down to in this setting is what side effects the patient will tolerate. Patients will talk about the different drugs. We don't have strong evidence that survival depends on a certain sequencing. We want them to be able to live their life as long as they can, doing the things they want to do. So a lot of patients want to avoid hair loss, and they can't with eribulin. They'd rather not be stuck in the infusion room. So they can't do that with eribulin because it's day one and day eight. And that's why I think a lot of patients will choose regimens like capecitabine earlier on, because it gives them that oral therapy, lack of hair loss, pretty well tolerated approach. And so the sequencing kind of depends on the patient. Do I think that patients that are BRCA positive, triple negative, do great on capecitabine? Usually not. They usually don't have really long PFS, especially if they are BRCA mutation carriers. However, I've had some patients with triple negative metastatic disease who've done well for several years on single agent capecitabine. So I think it's worth a trial. And I think this just gets down to the fact that triple negative is this catch-all for a very heterogeneous group of diseases.
So I want to switch over and get back to ER positive, HER2 negative disease and ask you about your 60-year-old lady.
She came to me with a 4-centimeter left-sided breast cancer clinically, about 4 centimeters, had biopsy. It was ER, PR strongly positive, HER2 negative, lower grade. She was offered actually the NeoMonarch study that I told you about, the abemaciclib with anastrozole, and looked at it and decided, no, I just want to get my mastectomy and do that right now. So she went to mastectomy, and she was found to have multifocal disease. So one of the tumors was 2.3 centimeters. ER strongly positive, PR weaker, but still positive, and HER2 negative, low Ki-67, around 10%. And then the second lesion was 1.5 centimeters, ER PR positive, Ki-67 less than 5%. And so all of her lymph nodes were negative. 11 were removed at the time. I'm not sure the details of why so many were removed, because I believe the intention was to do a sentinel lymph node biopsy. However, 11 were removed and none were involved. And so she came to me for follow-up and said, you know, I'd really like to avoid chemotherapy. Can I do so safely? Now, when I was a fellow in training, 10 years ago or so, it was, well, if a tumor is greater than 2 centimeters and you've got an otherwise very healthy woman, even who's 60, you should do chemo, because chemo.
Actually, it was 1 centimeter at one point.
Yes. Yes. So it's very knee-jerk kind of, this is what you do. It was simple.
Actually, there was a consensus conference that said 1 centimeter and you get chemo.
Right. So we decided to send Oncotype on the larger tumor, the 2.3 centimeter. The Ki-67 of that tumor was a little bit higher. And as you know, Oncotype is heavily driven by proliferation genes. So we sent it on that tumor, and the recurrence score ended up being 14. So by the current classification system on the recurrence score, that puts you in the low risk range. But if she had been enrolled in the TAILOR-X study, that would have been considered intermediate risk range. But that meant that she had a 9% chance of having a distant metastatic recurrence in the next 10 years, assuming that she took tamoxifen. And so we had a discussion about this. Ultimately, you know, we discussed the impact, potential impacts of chemotherapy on a score like this. And ultimately, she chose to not do chemotherapy, to move forward with aromatase inhibition, which seems appropriate.
What about the issue of the fact that there were two masses? Are there situations where you'll send the Oncotype on two different tumor specimens?
Yes, I have done that occasionally. For example, if a patient has a larger tumor, but it has more benign molecular features, more strongly ER and PR positive, Ki-67 is lower, and it's a 3.5 centimeter tumor, but then we have a 1 centimeter tumor and the Ki-67 is 20%. So I've had to fight the insurance company on that, because you get charged for both, and these are not cheap tests. But I do think it's important, because I'm of the belief that size doesn't matter in this situation, that biology is what really matters. And size is a surrogate marker for bad behaving tumors, and sometimes doesn't reflect accurately in an individual the danger or the risk.
Any thoughts about where things are going to be heading and where you're going to be heading in terms of use of genomic markers in this situation, early ER positive, HER2 negative disease, to determine whether or not to use chemo, and specifically whether or not mammoprint, the 70 gene assay, is, and right now we know from our surveys, is generally rarely used in the United States. Now they've got this big phase 3 MINDEC trial that was just reported at the AACR meeting that suggests some value in it. There were a bunch of node positive cases in it. What do you think about this alternative of the 70 gene assay?
Yeah, I think that the fact that we're not using it, I think probably what happened in America is the mammoprint originally required fresh tissue, so it was dependent on surgeons sending it in. And if you kind of lose your audience of oncologists early on, and they're getting trained on using the 21 gene recurrence score, it's hard to capture the audience later when you've learned how to use paraffin-embedded tissue. So I think that there is definitely value in mammoprint in that it is being validated in lymph node positive as opposed to Oncotype, which isn't as well validated in lymph node positive disease. I think that there are many questions that relate to the intermediate scores from Oncotype, and without the reporting of that data, we're still at a loss as to who should have chemo when they have an intermediate score. We're waiting for TAILOR-X to report out. And the mammoprint gives you a high versus low risk. There isn't this intermediate, which I think makes patients feel a lot more comfortable, certainly. So I have had patients with intermediate risk scores by Oncotype pay out of pocket to do their tumor test by mammoprint to make the decision whether or not to do chemo.
How do you approach the issue of using an assay like this in a patient with node positive disease? Again, there was an ASCO statement that came out that was very negative about it, which I thought was kind of amazing because I know from our surveys, a lot of very respected investigators have used Oncotype, for example, node early, you know, lower volume, one node, two node. And now the statement says, well, you're not using, I've heard people say it's hard to get it paid for now. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, there is a real difference between guidelines and consensus statement is what I was trying to say earlier. You know, guidelines are data-based and you can sort of feel a little bit more comfortable about them. There's a consensus statement relating to management of HER2-positive CNS disease because there's no data. So you have to take it with a grain of salt and realize that it's opinion-based, expert opinion, but opinion-based. There have certainly been patients with low volume nodal disease that I have sent Oncotype on. They tend to be my older patients, not my 35-year-old, but my 65, 70-year-old, who has one or two lymph nodes positive, but the tumor is low grade, the Ki-67 is less than 5% or less than 10%, strongly hormone receptor positive, lobular histology. And I really feel uncomfortable giving chemo just because I know that patient hasn't done a mammo in 5 years and that tumor has been growing for a very long time, and it's just the natural biology of the tumor, not because I think chemo is going to benefit the patient from a biological perspective. So I will use it to reassure me that the use of chemotherapy is likely not going to have an impact when I am advising a patient I think we can avoid chemo and lymph node positive disease. If I'm pretty sure that chemo is indicated, it's higher grade, and there are other features that are higher risk, lymphovascular invasion, and just, you know, Ki-67's higher or lack of PR expression, I tend not to do Oncotype because, you know, I already have a good feeling about the tumor and the need for chemotherapy.
There's another issue that's really interesting this case brings out, and that is the lady had a pretty large tumor, two of them actually. One was 4 centimeters. I think it's really interesting she was offered the neoadjuvant NeoMONARCH study looking at endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor, abemaciclib. But, you know, if, for example, she needed to have tumor shrinkage in order to have breast-conserving surgery, or maybe the tumor was, you know, 5 or 6 centimeters, she would have gotten chemo. And yet now we see that she's got a low recurrence score tumor.
Right.
So, you know, if she was just going to get non-trial neoadjuvant therapy, you know, should she have had a genomic assay and let that guide the decision?
Let me bring up 2 really good points. The first one is neoadjuvant chemotherapy in patients with tumors like hers rarely, you know, has a big impact. Path CR rates are on the order of 7% or less with chemotherapy and not much better with hormonal therapy alone. So I didn't feel that there was a conflict there for this patient because she had a low-grade tumor and not a high proliferation index. And her in particular, she had avoided having mammograms done. I think the prior one had been 3 years prior. So I think this was just an indolent tumor that she just missed. In terms of the NeoMonarch study, that study allows you to give the patient adjuvant chemotherapy. So for example, you know, if she were progressing, we could give it before surgery if we needed to. The study doesn't disallow that. And then after surgery, you can do whatever is clinically indicated. But your point about doing a genomic assay in a patient before neoadjuvant therapy is a good one. And in fact, in patients who I've put on this clinical trial who have, I've had one patient go to surgery and she had, you know, 3 centimeters of residual tumor found at the time of surgery after having 4 months of endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitor. And the question became, do we do chemo? And so you don't want to send the Oncotype DX on a patient's tumor after they've had endocrine therapy. You want to send it on the original biopsy because that change in Ki-67 is going to change the readout. And in the neoadjuvant setting, I think it's a good idea to be looking at the recurrence score or other genomic marker to help gauge benefit of chemo.
Yeah, in that same survey that I was mentioning, I was really surprised. I think about a third or more of the investigators were using a genomic assay, an ER positive, HER2 negative, you know, in the neoadjuvant situation, almost all Oncotype. So I guess some people, and you're saying sometimes you do that also?
Uh-huh, absolutely.
One other thing about, you know, genomic assays, and I've seen data with Oncotype suggesting that, you know, sort of tumor for tumor, Oncotype is used less in older patients. Mm. And I kind of was wondering whether or not maybe we don't consider chemotherapy enough in the woman who's 70, 75 years old, and that, you know, the little old lady that we go, oh, we don't want to give chemo to, if we knew had a high recurrence score, for example, we might be much more motivated to do it, particularly, you know, a less toxic non-anthracycline regimen.
Right.
What about your approach to genomic assays in older patients?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point you bring up. I'm actually more disinclined to do Oncotype in my younger patients because I'm concerned about avoiding chemo and I'm concerned about the applicability or the validity of this assay in very young women because the majority of the women in the studies used to build and validate Oncotype were postmenopausal and above the age of 50. So when I do an Oncotype in a woman in her 30s, I sort of cover it with caveats in my discussion with her about your risk may actually be higher because it wasn't only addressed in younger women who have other things going on from a hormonal perspective. In my older patients, you know, I haven't said this, but I think it's important to keep in mind that we're fairly good, in my opinion, at academic centers with a reliable pathologist who knows how to do grading of tumors and Ki-67, we're pretty good at predicting where a woman's going to land in their Oncotype. The IHC4 score done at, you know, I believe it was Mitch Dowsett who presented this data from Royal Marsden. IHC4 was comparable to recurrence score prediction in patients that he looked at. So if you've got a reliable ER, PR, HER2, and Ki-67, it's not entirely clear what doing Oncotype adds. And I feel that way for most of my patients. I've been surprised once in the last year by a high-risk Oncotype that I thought would be intermediate risk. I thought it was going to be in the 20s, and it was in the high 40s. And, you know, it turned out that the HER2 positive was wrong at my institution and was rechecked at a different institution. So I think that's what was driving it. But it's fairly easy to predict if you have a pathologist upon which you rely. And so if I have an older woman in her mid-70s with a high Ki-67 or high-grade tumor, I will talk to her about chemotherapy. And if she needs convincing and needs a number, the real benefit of Oncotype is giving a patient a percent risk in the next 10 years. They really like that number. And then looking at what happens to that number, or gauging what happens to that number with the use of chemo.
This concludes our program, and if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our program faculty, please email the case information and question to Dr. Neil Love at researchthepractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.